Chapter 3. Assyria. Circa 2000 BCE to 612 BCE. In the year 401 BCE, a Persian prince named Cyrus the Younger was fighting a bitter civil war against his brother for control of the imperial throne. To supplement his forces, he hired a mercenary army of mostly Greek soldiers, 10,000 spear-bearing hoplites who traveled the long road to Persia to fight on his behalf. Among them was the Greek writer and adventurer Xenophon, who later wrote about this expedition in his work Anabasis. Xenophon and his companions met the enemy Persian army at the Battle of Cunaxa, on the banks of the Euphrates. The Greek troops gave Cyrus value for his money, beating his brother's forces back and delivering a victory on their part of the field. But when the dust of the battle had cleared, they heard the bad news. Cyrus the Younger had been killed, apparently knocked from his horse by a young common soldier. His claim to the throne had died with him, and the war was over. In the chaos of the aftermath, the general who led the Greeks had also been killed, and all of the senior commanders were captured. The 10,000 mercenaries were now without a leader and stranded in the middle of a foreign land. Xenophon and the remainder of the Greeks knew that their only route home was to reach the Black Sea, which lay across the wide deserts of what is today Iraq. They were terrified. They had few supplies, and the enemy army was already pursuing them close behind. Xenophon was one of the soldiers hastily elected to command, and he told his men to throw away everything they carried, shedding weight in order to outrun their enemies. In this way, they pelted across the deserts and the fertile river lands dotted with date palms, following the Tigris River north. It was while fleeing in this manner that they stumbled upon something that must have made them stop in their tracks: the crumbling, deserted ruin of an enormous city, larger than anything Xenophon had seen back home in Greece. Later, he wrote about this discovery in Anabasis. They came upon a large deserted city, the name of which was Larissa, a place inhabited by the Medes in days of old. The breadth of its walls was 25 feet, and the height of them 100, and the circuit of the whole 2 parasangs. It was built of clay bricks, supported on a stone basis 20 feet high. By the side of this city, there was a stone pyramid, in breadth 100 feet and in height 200 feet. In it were many of the barbarians who had fled for refuge from the neighboring villages. With the Persians in hot pursuit, Xenophon didn't have time to linger, and so the Greeks pressed ahead. Then, only a day or two later, they came across another ruin, this one even larger and more impressive, surrounded by another fortified wall. They marched one stage of 6 parasangs to a great deserted fortress. The basement was made of polished stone full of shells. 50 feet was the breadth of it, and 50 feet the height, and on this basement was reared a wall of brick, the breadth whereof was 50 feet, and the height thereof 400. And the circuit of the wall was 6 parasangs. For days afterwards, Xenophon asked any local people they passed about these enormous constructions out there in the desert, but no one could tell him anything. Some thought they might have been built by the Medes, an ancient Iranian people who still occupied the area. Others told fantastical stories about the gods bringing down fire and thunder to destroy the ancient walls, killing everyone within. Today, we know that these cities were the famed metropolises of Nimrud and Nineveh, the greatest cities of the Assyrian Empire, and it's thought that Xenophon, at the end of the 5th century BCE, was the first person to write an account of their ruins. At that time, the first stones of the Parthenon in Athens had been laid only 50 years earlier. The Colosseum in Rome would not be built for nearly 500 years. But by then, Nineveh had already been a ruin for more than 2 centuries. This city had flourished into a towering capital, home to hundreds of thousands of people, given birth to some of the ancient world's most beautiful art and architecture, and then, all at once, had fallen into dust. Xenophon and his men eventually made it back to Greece, and he would survive to write his account. Today, when we read about his experiences in Anabasis, some of the most affecting moments are when he must have looked out over the sand-blasted desert, at the grasses sprouting between the crumbling bricks of those abandoned cities, the hot wind battering his hair and tugging at his clothes, and wondered what in all the world could have happened here. To us, the Assyrian Empire belongs to what feels like an impossibly distant past. But the citizens of Nineveh and Nimrud already considered themselves to be the inheritors of a long and fabled history. Since the invention of writing by the Sumerians around 3200 BCE, humans had been passing their knowledge down through the generations. As a result, the Assyrians held on to the memory of several of the kings of the Sumerian age, revering them as semi-mythical heroes. Among these were the hero of the epic, Gilgamesh, and the Akkadian king, Sargon the Great, who, for the later Assyrians, was about as distant in their past as we are from Julius Caesar. Like the Sumerians before them, the Assyrians saw the ruins of ancient cities scattering their landscape and believed them to be the remnants left behind by a great flood that had once washed over the world. Since the fall of the Neo-Sumerian Empire, the language of Akkadian had become the region's most widespread, and the Akkadian-speaking cities of the north were finally free to prosper under their own rule. One of these was the city of Ashur. Ashur was occupied from at least 2500 BCE, and it grew quickly, in part thanks to its natural advantages. It was nestled in a bend of the Tigris, about halfway between the modern cities of Tikrit and Mosul, and this watercourse sheltered it on its north and east sides, as well as making it a natural stop along the river trade route. As a consequence, the city soon became wealthy. Excavations show that by the 2nd millennium, many of its dwellings were spacious mansions, and it became common for wealthy families to keep vaults beneath their floors to hide their many valuables, jewelry made of gold and polished brass, inlaid with semi-precious stones like carnelian, agate, and lapis lazuli. Excavations have even uncovered dozens of private libraries and archives in the city, where texts written on cuneiform on clay tablets were stored, a clear indicator of a city overflowing with wealth. The rich families of Ashur were also able to donate handsomely to religious institutions, and the city became home to no fewer than 34 temples to the various gods worshipped by all the people of Mesopotamia. The sun god Shamash and the moon god Sin, the storm god Adad, the water god Ea, once known as Enki, Ishtar, the goddess of love and war, and the king of the gods, Enlil. We can imagine incantations washing out of the temple doors into the city streets, the priests competing for attention in the crowded city, the ringing of bells and banging of drums, the singing of hymns. Funeral processions may have floated past, chanting devotionals such as this one to the Babylonian god Marduk. The man who is departing in glory, may his soul shine radiant as brass. To that man may the sun give life. And Marduk, eldest son of heaven, grant him an abode of happiness. The temples also performed services for the sick. If you visited the temple of Ishtar with an ailment, you might hear something like this prayer being said over you by one of its priests. Bind the sick man to heaven, for from earth he is being torn away. Of the brave man who was so strong, his strength has departed. In his bodily frame, he lies dangerously ill. But Ishtar, who in her dwelling is grieved for him, descends from her mountain, unvisited of men. To the door of the sick man, she comes. Soon, like most cities of this time, Ashur developed a god of its own. In fact, the city virtually became a god. In the religious imagination of Mesopotamia, gods were closely associated with cities. Each city had a god, in the way that every sports team has a mascot, and the god was believed to live in the highest chamber of the city's temple, often in a statue dedicated to them. If you visited another city on business, it was considered sensible to give an offering to the city's god while you were there. And if two cities went to war, it was thought that their gods were battling it out in the heavens, just as human armies were fighting down on earth. As a consequence, the more a city succeeded, the more power its god was presumed to have. As the city of Ashur grew in importance, so the cult of the god Ashur was born. Grand temples were thrown up to this new deity. And as the city went from strength to strength, worship of Ashur rose to become the highest form of religious observance for its people. From what we can tell, this god rapidly took on new symbols and iconography. He became thought of as a robed man wearing a crown and holding a bow, often appearing in carvings at the center of a winged disc, looking down on the world and the golden city over which he presided. As the confidence of the cult of Ashur grew, eventually Enlil's position as king of the gods, which he had held for 1,000 years since the Sumerian age, was in jeopardy. Over the next centuries, the god Ashur even took over Enlil's wife, the goddess Ninlil, and his sons, Ninurta and Sababa. In a cuckoo-like displacement, Ashur, and not Enlil, was now the supreme god for this city's people. The people of the city of Ashur would soon become known as Ashurai. Today, we call them Assyrians. Like many of the powerful cities of this region, for the next millennium or so, the Assyrians of Ashur would make several attempts to found their own kingdom. Some of their earlier kings made impressive bids to build a larger empire, but the eastern Mediterranean around this time was a crowded field. At various times, Ashur found itself butting up against the powerful empires of Babylon, the Mitanni, and the Hittites, at times even being absorbed by them. All this would change as the Late Bronze Age collapse swept over the eastern Mediterranean, and like a great forest fire, cleared away many of the region's former great powers. But in the period of desolation that followed the collapse, Assyria too was struggling. The historian Georges Roux summarizes its situation. Towards the end of the 12th century BCE, Assyria was at her lowest ebb. Economic collapse was impending. She had lost all her possessions west of the Tigris and her vital arteries. The great trade routes that ran through the mountain passes were in foreign hands. Hostile Highlanders occupied not only the heights of the Zagros, but the foothills down to the edge of the Tigris Valley, while Aramean tribes pitched their tents almost at the gates of Ashur. By now, Assyria's territory consisted of little more than a strip of land along the Tigris, surrounded on all sides by determined enemies. But there were also things to be thankful for. For one thing, Assyria's rivals were incapable of uniting, and this single fact would prove crucial for Assyrian survival. For much of its history, its enemies hated each other as much as they hated the Assyrians. Having little in the way of natural boundaries or defenses on the plains, Assyria relied on the fact that its enemies could be dealt with one by one. The powerful Assyrian army could march one way, then the other, smashing each enemy in turn. The main cities of Assyria had also been able to continue their economic output throughout the crisis of the Bronze Age collapse, and so had fared better than many rivals. Assyria still had chariots and horses and weapons. It had access to iron and was beginning to use steel to forge powerful new weapons and armor. Their warriors had been trained by years of constant fighting and were now among the best in the world. And perhaps most importantly, the line of royal succession had supposedly not been broken for more than 200 years, meaning that the kings of Assyria drew on an ancient and unchallenged legitimacy among their people. No other state of the time could say the same. And to at least one Assyrian king, it must have seemed that if Assyria could only seize its opportunity, it could become a power unlike any seen before. That king was Tiglath-Pileser I. Tiglath-Pileser ascended to the throne in 1114 BCE. He was the son of a remorseless ruler named Ashur-resha-ishi, who had named himself the Avenger of Assyria and the Merciless Hero of Battle. Tiglath-Pileser continued this ferocious reputation, and it's clear he was an energetic ruler and a skillful campaigner. One of his typically overflowing royal inscriptions describes him in the following manner. Unrivaled king of the universe, king of the four quarters, king of all princes, lord of lords, whose weapons the god Ashur has sharpened and whose name he has pronounced eternally for control of the four quarters. Splendid flame which covers the hostile land like a rainstorm. Tiglath-Pileser inherited an Assyria that was threatened on multiple fronts. In the north, climate shifts had been driving nomadic horsemen into the northern plains. The Mushku people of Syria had occupied certain Assyrian districts in the upper Euphrates Valley for 50 years, while the Hittite people had also snatched some of its territories. And to the south lay the powerful city of Babylon, Assyria's ancient rival. Today, the Arabic name for the region of Upper Mesopotamia still captures this feeling of isolation. They call it Al-Jazira, the island. Tiglath-Pileser drove out first the Mushku, then the Hittites and Arameans. Everywhere he went, he placed a record of his victories. In one of the strong fortresses he built to solidify his conquests, he engraved the following message on a series of copper plates in the base of the walls. Altogether, I conquered 42 lands and their rulers, from the upper side of the lower Zab in distant mountainous regions to the other side of the Euphrates, people of Hatti, and the upper sea in the west. Tiglath-Pileser I loved to hunt, and he delighted in bringing back live specimens of animals from the faraway lands that he campaigned in. I killed 10 strong bull elephants in the land Haran and the region of the river Habur, and 4 live elephants I captured. I brought the hides and tusks of the dead elephants, along with the live elephants, back to my city of Ashur. We can imagine the bustle of Ashur at this time. Teams of construction laborers working day and night to build new palaces. Exotic, never-before-seen animals in its pleasure gardens. While access to new trade routes brought new spices and fabrics to the city markets. Tiglath-Pileser swept his Assyrian armies west and conquered cities as he went. When he conquered the Hittite town of Pitru, he gained control of the highway to the Mediterranean. Assyria at this time was the only great power in the region with no access to a coastline. And we can see something of the wonder in the king's words when he boasts about going on board a ship. The chronicles even record that he hunted and killed a sea creature known as a Naharu, perhaps a dolphin. I rode in boats of the people of Arvad and traveled successfully a distance of 3 double hours from the city Arvad, an island, to the city Samuru, which is in the land Amuru. I killed at sea a Naharu, which is called a seahorse. Tiglath-Pileser I died in 1076 BCE, having grown his kingdom into an empire that was all but unmatched in the region. As his own end grew near, he must have looked ahead to the dawning of a golden age for Assyria. And indeed, the kings who followed were able to continue the empire's expansion into Anatolia, Persia, Babylonia, and the Levant. But the Assyrians were already sowing the seeds of their own destruction. For one thing, they were increasingly seen across the region as harsh, even cruel rulers. King Ashur-nazirpal II, who ascended the throne in 883 BCE, was renowned for his remorselessness. Though he was by no means the first Assyrian king to do so, he made unprecedented use of terror tactics, torture, execution, and mass deportations to drive fear into the hearts of his enemies. His inscriptions, above all those of the Assyrian kings, stand out for the delight they seem to take in the details of his campaign of terror. I burnt many captives. I captured many troops alive. From some I cut off their arms and hands. From others I cut off their noses, ears, and extremities. I gouged out the eyes of many troops. I made one pile of the living and one of heads. I hung their heads on trees around the city. I burnt their adolescent boys and girls. I razed, destroyed, burnt, and consumed the city. Whether because of these tactics or despite them, in the short term, Ashur-nazirpal was an effective conqueror. But by the final years of the reign of his son, Shalmaneser III, the people had had enough. 27 cities, including Ashur itself, rose up in rebellion. In the long and bitter civil war that ensued, virtually all the people that Ashur-nazirpal had conquered shook off Assyrian rule. Assyria's heavy-handed military domination of the region had made them hate it. If they hoped to sustain a lasting empire, something would have to change. And the king who would eventually inherit this mess, who ruled as Tiglath-Pileser III, thought he knew what that something was. But it was not a softer and more diplomatic approach. He decided in characteristic Assyrian fashion that what the empire needed was an even more powerful army. Up until the mid-8th century BCE, the Assyrian army was much the same as any other Mesopotamian force, only a good deal larger. King Shalmaneser III once boasted a force of 120,000 men in his campaigns against Syria, at a time when the world population has been estimated at only 50 million people. If his inscriptions are to be believed, then around 0.25%, or 1 in every 400 of the global population, was at that moment serving in the Assyrian army. Nevertheless, it was still a force mostly made up of peasant farmers, and this had long presented a problem. The empire could summon a horde of soldiers, plucked from their lands whenever the need arose. But when the autumn came around and the barley was golden in the fields, these armies of farmers had to march right back home and bring in the crops. Otherwise, the empire would go hungry. Gathering this huge army from the fields was also an immensely time-consuming and difficult task. Rebellions could break out at any time of year, but if one occurred in some far corner of the empire, it couldn't be crushed until summertime. If the people of a rebellious city were clever, they could simply lock the gates and wait behind their walls for the armies of Assyria to go away, and in many cases, that is exactly what they did. But in the mid-8th century BCE, the new king Tiglath-Pileser III embarked on a radical program of reforming the Assyrian military, creating forces of elite armored troops, cavalry, and chariots. Meanwhile, conquered territories on the edges of the empire supplied the army's light infantry, who were considered expendable and often bore the brunt of the casualties. He also pioneered the use of a large engineering component to the fighting force. Soon, Assyrian soldiers could build bridges and dig tunnels, construct fortifications and siege engines, as well as maintain the supply lines to keep the army going. Assyrian carvings show remarkably detailed scenes of the army crossing one of the great rivers, something they must have had to do multiple times a year. We see animal skins being inflated as buoyancy aids, chariots dismantled and turned into boats, rafts constructed to transport supplies and equipment. Tiglath-Pileser III also increased production of iron and steel in the empire. Assyrian cities of this time must have become increasingly smoke-filled, the furnaces belching charcoal smoke, the sound of bellows and clanging hammers echoing off the buildings. The Assyrians entered a new era of iron mass production, using the metal to make knives, pins and chains, but also arrowheads, swords, spear blades, helmets, and even iron scales that were sewn into soldiers' tunics for protection. The effect of these reforms was immediate. In 743 BCE, Tiglath-Pileser III marched north against the kingdom of Urartu and conquered it easily. 2 years later, he marched west against the kingdom of Arpad. The people of Arpad had fought the Assyrians before, and they knew what to do. Simply close up their city gates and hold tight until the end of summer came. But as summer ended and autumn arrived, the people of Arpad must have realized that something was wrong. The Assyrians showed no sign of going home. In fact, it looked like they were settling in for a long stay. Tiglath-Pileser III laid siege to the city of Arpad for 3 years, something that would have been impossible with the old seasonal armies. When the city finally fell, he ordered it to be destroyed and its inhabitants slaughtered. In campaign after campaign, Tiglath-Pileser III conquered lands in Syria and marched his new professional army down the Mediterranean coast, taking coastal cities all the way to Egypt. He invaded the northern Hebrew kingdom of Israel, destroyed their forces, installed a puppet king, and deported large numbers of Hebrew tribes to lands in Assyria. Perhaps most notably, he added one other remarkable new possession, Babylon, which had been the political and religious center of southern Mesopotamia for more than 1,000 years. The division between Assyria and Babylonia was an ancient one. Once Mesopotamia had been divided between Sumerians in the south and Akkadians in the north, But this had now evolved to become Babylonians in the south and Assyrians in the north. It's a cultural division that still echoes today, since the distribution of the Sunni and Shia populations in modern Iraq roughly follows this same geographical divide. Tiglath-Pileser III's conquest of Babylon shifted the balance of power in Mesopotamia, and it became one of the jewels in his crown. By 736 BCE, his empire encompassed almost the whole of the Fertile Crescent, and he controlled an unbroken corridor from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean that linked the trade routes of the Indian Ocean with those of North Africa and Europe. It was this empire, and the formidable, seemingly unstoppable army it now commanded, that Tiglath-Pileser III would pass down to his younger son, who was to found the greatest dynasty of the Assyrians. His name was Sargon II, named after the ancient Akkadian hero, and his dynasty would become known as the Sargonid Kings. They would rule for three generations that would represent the highest point of the empire's achievements in war, art, and literature, but they would also be the twilight of its age. With the last of these three generations, the empire would collapse in ash and flame. The drama of the Sargonid Kings is one of the most remarkable family sagas to come down to us from the ancient world, and it truly begins with the son of Sargon, Sennacherib, who came to the throne in 705 BCE. Sargon II had been a respected and feared king, but for some reason, Sennacherib couldn't quite command the same level of respect. After only 2 years of his rule, several Assyrian vassals in the foothills to the east, in Syria and along the Mediterranean coast, all suddenly stopped paying their tribute. The Egyptians, always happy to throw sand in the face of the Assyrians, moved to back the rebels, and the young Sennacherib found himself plunged into a fight for the empire's survival. The new king quickly gathered the imperial army and dealt with the rebels in the usual Assyrian way, rounding on them one by one. He marched east and subjugated the peoples of the Iranian lowlands, then marched north and around the Fertile Crescent to the Mediterranean coast to reconquer the rebellious kingdoms there. One of these campaigns is notable because we have accounts of it written both by the winners and the losers, in a level of detail almost unprecedented anywhere else in the 8th century BCE. These records have survived not only in the chronicles of Assyria, but also in the Bible. This was Sennacherib's campaign against the kingdom of Judah. The kingdom of Judah was the second and more southerly of the region's two major Hebrew kingdoms, centered on the powerful city of Jerusalem. Its king at the time was called Hezekiah, an energetic ruler driven by religious fervor, as the Old Testament Book of Kings tells us. Hezekiah did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David his father had done. He removed the high places and broke the pillars, and he broke in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, for unto those days the children of Israel did offer to it. Perhaps it was Hezekiah's religious devotion that led him to make the enormous gamble of defying the Assyrian Empire. Perhaps the most recent rebellions in the empire had emboldened him, and he believed that it might be on the brink of collapse. Whatever his calculation, it backfired completely. He soon heard news that Sennacherib was marching on Judah with the full force of the Assyrian war machine. Sennacherib first conquered the rebels of Ekron in Philistia, then Judah's fortified second city of Lachish, a victory recorded in a striking series of reliefs unearthed from the southwest palace at Nineveh, before making his way to Jerusalem. Hezekiah was ready. He had built a new wall around the city and dug an underground tunnel through solid stone that would bring in fresh water during any siege. But even so, the situation must have looked dire. The Judean king decided to negotiate. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, I have offended. Return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. To pay the bounty, this devout king even stripped the gold from the temple in Jerusalem. However, Sennacherib was not appeased, and it looked as though all was lost for the defenders of Jerusalem. But then their luck turned. The Hebrew poets who wrote the Book of Kings recount King Hezekiah praying to his God to deliver him from the Assyrians, and this reply coming down to him. Hast thou not heard long ago how I have done it, and of ancient times that I have formed it? Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldest be to lay waste fenced cities into ruinous heaps. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed, and went and returned, and dwelt at Nineveh. The most likely explanation is probably an outbreak of plague among the Assyrian army, a constant threat to any besieging force. The Assyrian sources are understandably quiet about what must have been an embarrassing defeat. The only inscription to mention this campaign focuses on the early victories won by the Assyrians and on the massive tribute they exacted. Still, perhaps it was this embarrassment that led the recently conquered people of Babylon to desire their freedom.